Your friends may lie. The truth can come from strangers. If I knew why, we wouldn't be in this danger, leaning out the window of my car and wishing on another lucky star.
Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com, movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm super excited for this week's very special show, because at long last, I am joined by a man whose name comes up at least once a week on this podcast. You know him as the co-host of the Pure Cinema podcast, as the host of the Just the Discs podcast, and of the proprietor of the Great Rupert Pupkin Speaks blog. Please welcome to the show, Brian Sauer. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you so much. That was really a very kind introduction.
Well, listen, it's true. Especially when Stephanie comes on, she just teases me about how much I talk about you. So it's nice to have you on so that she'll at least believe that we're friends.
Yeah. Well, I just can't believe I haven't been on yet, and I apologize for that, because I've been a fan of yours for a long time, and I said more or less this on Just the Disc when you came on for the best of the year list episode, which was a lot of fun. I'm a big fan of you and your writing and your podcasting, and so it is my distinct pleasure to be on the show. Thank you, sir.
Well, it's great to have you. There is a series going on right now at Rupert Pupkin Speaks called Underrated 88. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Thank you for indulging me, first of all. I do lists, has been a regular thing with the blog for years. I think it started around 2010, and it was just me doing lists, and then I was inviting other people to do lists. But in the last 3 or 4 years, I think, I've settled into like underrated year lists, because basically we ran through, you know, underrated horror and just every other genre that I could think of. So I'm like, let's just do years. That's a nice parameter. So we go back 10, 20, 30, 40 years from the present year. And we've already done 98. Thank you for doing a list for that, by the way. And now we're on 88, which is a lovely year, by the way, and I'm getting a lot of people telling me that it's very difficult to narrow down their underrateds because there's so much good stuff.
There is a ton of good stuff, and I found, as I was trying to put my list together, that you know, I'm always trying to find something that maybe not everybody else is going to name, just because I have this thing that I always repeat where, you know, it's always great to talk about more movies than fewer, so the more movies people can read about, the better. But with 88, it was hard because I felt like even the movies that I think are underrated are, at least in my mind, kind of beloved, even as, you know, the kinds of cult movies that you guys talk about on Pure Cinema.
Yeah, it's a tough thing, the whole underrated. I've gotten some backlash from it because certain folks are just like, well, that movie's not underrated, it's underseen and blah, blah, blah. And yes, you're right. No, absolutely. For me, I've always said it's just a way to hook people. And you say underrated, right, right. You get their attention. But yeah, especially in the age of film Twitter, it's really difficult and subjective to know what's underrated. So yeah, it's hard. You just try and dig for some obscurities, and you always do a really interesting and good job of it. So I don't know. It's a tough one. I agree, though.
I always like to have one Albert Pyun movie on my list, but I think his only 88 movie this year was Alien from LA, and I was like, nope, that's a bridge too far. I can't do it.
So yeah, I understand.
He didn't make the list this time. But
are there any other Kathy Ireland movies you could have put on?
Yeah, from 88. I can only name that one and Necessary Roughness. Did she do many other movies?
I think you've got me. That's as far as my knowledge of filmography goes.
That's the filmography. Anyway, to tie into that series, we thought it might be fun to dedicate an episode of this show to underrated movies of 1988 to kind of do the list format to steal from you and Elric. So I feel okay about stealing it because you're on the show.
Yes, if I was... I am perfectly happy to do it.
Yes. So we're going to name five movies each from 1988 that we feel are underrated. And being the guest, I would love it if you would go first.
Well, thank you. Well, I did something that I really appreciated you doing. Hopefully this isn't a peek behind the curtain that nobody wants to talk about but or see or hear. But you were kind enough when you did a list for my blog, you also switched out one or two titles for the podcast or vice versa. I can't remember which. So I've already done my underrated 88 list on my site, but this first movie is one that I didn't have on my list on my site and is an F This Movie exclusive.
Yes, finally.
So, yes, I mean, you know, your mileage will vary with this one, but I enjoyed it. It is a movie called Plain Clothes, and you and I were tweeting about it a while back.
Yes.
It is directed by Martha Coolidge, who did two of my favorite films of all time, and Valley Girl and Real Genius. She's fantastic as a director, and this is the sort of follow-up for Arliss Howard to Full Metal Jacket. Which is very odd because this movie is tonally, I guess you could say, kind of a mess, but I still kind of like it. It's basically like he plays a cop whose brother has been framed for the murder of a teacher. And so he infiltrates the school by pretending to be a student. And the sort of mystery begins to unravel through that. But what's really fun about this one is the cast, besides Arliss Howard, who I like, but I don't know. We had talked about it on Twitter. Maybe not a leading man. I'm not sure. But I do like him. You've got Robert Stack plays the principal. George Wendt plays a shop teacher, a very creepy and kind of weird shop teacher. And Abe Vigoda is a teacher in the school. I forget what he teaches, but there's a running joke where they keep putting signs on his back that say things like, still alive and party naked and stuff like that. And then Reginald Vell Johnson plays Arliss Howard's police captain, and Diane Ladd is, I want to say, like one of the administrators at the school, and Susie Amos, James Cameron's wife, plays a teacher, sort of love interest. Screenplay is by Scott Frank of Out of Sight, Get Shorty, Minority Report, and Logan fame.
I don't think I ever put it together that Scott Frank wrote it.
Yeah, I definitely did not until this time. But yeah, so it's a weird sort of tonal mix of like comedy, like fish out of water, high school stuff, and then kind of thrillery stuff that I think kind of works, you know. The one interesting thing I heard in the commentary, which there's a Blu-ray from Olive that has a commentary, which is rare. And she said apparently she was all set. This is Martha Coolidge, was all set to direct Some Kind of Wonderful. She'd been prepping it. And at the last minute, John Hughes replaced her, apparently. What a dick. And so Paramount felt so bad. They just were like, we'll give you the first movie we can find for you. And Plain Clothes was the first movie. So that's what she got. But it's fun. Oh, Seymour Cassell is his partner. I forgot about that.
Oh,
that's another great cast.
Did this movie get much of a theatrical release? Because I remember as a kid, like, it only came on my radar when it showed up on cable. It was like, where did this movie come from? I don't remember this ever coming out.
You know what? I don't think she addressed it in the commentary, but, or maybe she, I don't think it got a great release. I don't think it was like, you know, fully supported by the studio at the time. It's a difficult movie to sell, you know.
America wasn't ready for Arliss Howard. I watched this movie so many times as a kid on HBO. Like, this was just
awesome.
Constant rotation. And my memories are like, Arliss Howard has a weird approach to acting in this movie. It's sort of very deadpan. He's completely unconvincing as a high school student, which the movie sort of tries to make a joke out of, right?
Yes.
And his last name is Springsteen, and they keep saying no relation. Am I remembering these things right?
No. He says distant relation.
Distant. Okay. I got the joke wrong.
It's not a great joke, but yeah, he shows up at school the first day as like a punk and then reconsiders that outfit and becomes like kind of a hipster, I guess, with
a
hat.
Yeah.
So it's one of the rare times when the costume or, you know, character that the cop has committed to is like wrong and they change it up, which I think is funny.
I feel like the closest cousin of this movie would be Hiding Out. And not just because it's also about an adult who goes back to high school, sort of. I mean, Never Been Kissed does the same thing, but it has those same weird tonal inconsistencies where, you know, by the end of Hiding Out, people are shooting at each other and you're like, wait, how is this the same movie about the adult in high school?
100% on the mark. I think it would be an interesting double feature. but yeah, there are some really serious dark tonal turns in Hiding Out. And a lot of comedy, too. That's actually one of my favorite John Cryer movies.
It's a good one. But then they both, anytime you have this plot where, like, the adult goes to high school, you know, they have to introduce a romance. And both of these movies, both this and Hiding Out, they kind of go in two separate directions, but they're both probably inappropriate. Where in Hiding Out, it's John Cryer and a student, played by Annabeth Gish. And in Plain Clothes, it's Arliss Howard and a teacher. Which, you know, is fine because they're both adults, but as far as she knows, he's a high school student, right?
Yes, it's problematic. I mean, thankfully, you know, it's less problematic than Hiding Out because we know they're of age and adults. But yeah, from her point of view, it is a little creepy, definitely.
I remember Never Been Kissed doing the same thing, and I was like, wait, how am I supposed to feel good about this? He thinks she's a student.
Yes.
No, that's a really good pick. You've made me want to revisit that movie, so I'm excited that there's a Blu-ray.
I just think it deserves a little more attention for those that like Valley Girl and Real Genius. You know, it's got some good comedic moments, and you know, she's a good solid director, so it's worthwhile
for sure. And you know, if she had directed Some Kind of Wonderful, we never would have gotten the union of Leah Thompson and Howie Deutsch. So.
It's true.
They are married to this day, all because Martha Coolidge got fired off of Some Kind of Wonderful.
Well, I guess that's something, I suppose.
So we got their marriage and Plain Clothes out of it.
Woo! What a bargain.
My first pick is my most obvious pick because it's a movie that I've talked about so many times on our website. And over on Daily Dead or Corpse Club. And that is Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers, directed by one of my favorite directors, Dwight H. Little, who does not get nearly as much love as he should get. He also directed the Robert Englund Phantom of the Paradise. He directed Marked for Death. He directed Rapid Fire, which is like one of my favorite action movies of all time.
Coming to Blu-ray soon.
I know, from Twilight Time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Halloween 4, I've said this before, and I know that it is blasphemy. I know that what I'm saying is wrong, and people will be angry. If I'm going to... I love, you know, the first four Halloween movies pretty unconditionally. I'll watch any one of them at any time. But I reach for Halloween 4 the most. It's probably my favorite of the four, and I know that's blasphemy because the original Halloween is a legit masterpiece. It's a perfect movie, but for some reason, there's something about Halloween 4 that I'm more drawn to. I really think it comes down to I like those characters better. I like spending time with Ellie Cornell and Daniel Harris and their relationship. I really like the kind of autumn atmosphere that Dwight Little creates. I think there's some nice set pieces. There's some stuff that doesn't work. The mask is horrible. There are a few incidents of like slightly more graphic 80s gore. I just think this is a movie that gets written off even by horror movie fans. I think, you know, most horror fans are like, yeah, you can watch the first Halloween or the first three Halloweens. And then after that, they're all pretty worthless, which breaks my heart when I hear it because I'm a huge fan of Halloween 4.
I am absolutely, as I say on Pure Cinema a lot, I'm due for a rewatch because I have not seen it since VHS, despite owning that Anchor Bay Screen Factory Blu-ray set. But I'm fully with you in terms of the idea of I reach for X more than the classic original film. You know, I mean, I have a lot of movies like that, and I don't ever fault people for that. There's something about, you know, being comfortable with a certain movie. Like you said, that I like that about the autumn setting, you know, like that's something that if you're a big Halloween fan, I mean, the time of year, as I know that you are,
yes,
that could be a real draw. And, you know, some of those sort of intangibles, I think, end up really bringing you back to movies more than you expect.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a fight that I've been fighting for much of my life, but it's like this one gets shown all the time during Fear Fest. Is that what they call it now on AMC? Because I don't know, they got the rights to the Halloween movies a few years ago and just play them to death. So in October, AMC is showing Halloween 4 like once a day, and I always have to keep it on. If I go past it, that's it. I'm done. I have to keep it on until it ends and they start Halloween 5, and then I can easily turn it off because I'm not a fan of Halloween 5.
Yeah, I don't remember Halloween 5 much at all. Yeah, my memory picks up with H2O, and that's it, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's a cool one, man. I definitely often feel like I don't have the franchise cred that I should, because I haven't seen, you know, some of the later entries in the Nightmare and Halloween series very many times. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that makes me not as good of a horror fan, and I'm kind of ashamed of it, to be honest.
I don't think that's the case.
but I do remember liking that one quite a bit, so I got to get around to it again.
Yeah.
So you're pushing me in that direction. I appreciate it.
All right.
My next pick is a movie called Crossing Delancey. And this is from director Joan Micklin-Silver, who did one of my favorite films of all time, and it's called Chilly Scenes of Winter. Mm-hmm. Also on Blu-ray from Twilight Time, by the way. And it's just a really adorable sort of romantic drama set in New York. And actually, in rewatching it, I was like, oh, this could have been on... never mind. I'm not going to keep dropping Pure Cinema on this show.
No, it's fine.
I keep doing that. But we did a New York movies list, and I was like, well, this could have easily made the bottom of the list. It's that good of a movie.
Right.
But it's just very low-key. But basically, the story is that Amy Irving plays this woman who works in an uptown New York City bookstore, and she has a thing for a local author who is played by this guy... I don't remember the actor's name, but he plays the other doctor in The Fugitive. And I don't want to spoil The Fugitive for anybody, but he's not necessarily of great moral character.
Right.
And so he always plays like this like quasi vaguely European and skeezy kind of dude. And he is
He's the bad guy in Living Daylights also?
I think so.
Okay.
I'm
thinking of the right guy then.
But I can't think of his name. I apologize.
I want to say
but
it's
anyway,
like a
he's
French name.
Yeah, I think you're right. But so Amy Irving's grandmother sets her up with like a local marriage broker without her permission. And the woman tries to match her with this very blue collar guy who runs a pickle store on the Lower East Side, played by Peter Riegert, who is one of my favorite character actors of all time. I just think he's absolutely stellar. I mean, if you see, he's got a smaller part in Chilly Scenes of Winter, but he's fucking hilarious in that movie. Mm-hmm. But if you watch something like Local Hero, Bill Forsyth's movie, he's really good in that. He's really good in this movie called Cold Blooded with Jason Priestley, which is really hard to see right now, but it's about it's a dark comedy about hitmen, and he plays like the mentor hitman mm-hmm. to Jason Priestley in that.
And that comes up a lot on Pure Cinema also.
Yeah, I wish it was more available because I like to talk about it. But anyway, I just love him, and he is just really charming as this guy who's like really into Amy Irving, but she's, you know, kind of like wishy-washy about it. And I think she's kind of turned off by the idea that he sells pickles. You know, she's just kind of a snob. The movie suffers slightly from what I call the unworthy romantic object of desire syndrome, but you know, I can get by that. You know, I find a lot of movies have that, where you have the romantic interest or the main character is interested in somebody who sucks, and sometimes they themselves kind of suck a little bit, and you're rooting for the side character to succeed romantically, and it's a weird dynamic, because you're like, I don't think the filmmaker wants me to think this person sucks, but they do suck a little bit. So anyway, Rygaard is just really, really charming and funny, and I just love him. So he really is the heart of the movie and keeps the whole thing afloat. But it's woefully underseen, outside of, I guess, like a sort of percentage of New Yorkers of a certain age really know this movie, but I don't run with that crowd necessarily. So I don't know that, because a lot of people I know don't really know the movie at all. So yeah. It seemed like a good pick for this.
It is a great pick. I only recently saw it probably 6 months ago, and I just kind of watched it on a whim. It was a movie that I had always known the title, and I was kind of, I knew the poster art, but you know, I was I think like 10 years old when it came out. And so this movie held no appeal for me. I don't know what the title means. I barely know who Amy Irving is. I'm like, what is this movie? So I went years without seeing it, and then finally caught up with it about 6 months ago, having finally seen Chilly Scenes of Winter. And then I was like wanting to check out more of Joan Micklyn Silver's work. And I know this is a thing that's going to come up probably more than once on this show. And it's something that I mention a lot on this podcast. Because really it's probably up until about the early 2000s. Like, there's just a kind of movie that doesn't exist anymore. The fact that a sort of romantic drama, that has like threads of Judaism that are very important in the film. That stars Peter Rygaard as the romantic lead who sells pickles. I mean, and like all of these elements, this movie is not getting a green light now, and it's certainly not playing at movie theaters, you know. And this movie came out, you could go see it on the big screen. Like, a studio invested money in this kind of small character drama, and a romance that's directed at adults. You know, it's not like some goofy romantic comedy where she's getting jizz in her hair or something. It's like just this kind of very gentle movie about two adults who are afraid of being hurt, you know, and it's a very, very sweet movie.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And you're right. It doesn't get made now. And some of her earlier films, I'm thinking especially of Hester Street, which I would recommend to you if you haven't seen it, is even more, has even more of the sort of Jewish American content, because it's about, like early 1896 New York, and this Russian Jewish man has emigrated to the United States, and he's settled there, and he's bringing, his wife over, and there's like this whole sort of fish out of water sort of character getting used to different customs and traditions kind of thing. And it's really good and really warm. And she just has an incredible touch for this kind of material, you know, I just find few directors can pull off or even care to pull off. Mm-hmm. So it's something else.
Chilly Scenes of Winter was like not on my radar at all. I think I was writing for a site and I was reviewing discs, and so it showed up on the list of what was available. This was maybe a few months before it came up on your show. So there was a list of stuff available, and I was like, well, this is from Twilight Time. John Hurt is in it. Like, okay, sure, I'll check it out. And I was pretty blown away by it. And so that was really the first time I even became aware of Joan Micklyn Silver. And I mean, just based on that one movie, it's like, oh, this is a real voice. You know, this is a very unique filmmaker. So I definitely want to check out more of her stuff, because I think I've only seen that and Crossing Delancey.
Oh, well, you know, just one more quick recommendation. If you get a chance, check out Between the Lines. that's from 77, which is the story of an underground newspaper in Boston that's being taken over by like a bigger business. And the cast is insane. It's John Hurt again, and he's great. But there's Lindsay Krause, Jeff Goldblum, Jill Eikenberry, Bruno Kirby, Gwen Wells, a big Altman actor. And I feel like Michael J. Pollard, Joe Morton,
holy cow,
Mary Lou Henner. It's insane. The wow. cast is really good. It's only available as an MOD DVD right now, I think.
Okay.
But it's well worth checking out, and one that I consider part of her like core group of like great movies. And yeah, she's something else. She's really one of my favorite lady directors, if we're going to break it down that way. And I don't need to do that, but she's just a fantastic director.
I will track down that movie right away. That sounds, just the cast sounds amazing.
Yeah, what she can get out of John Hurd, I mean, is, I don't know, mind-blowing. I mean, he's great. I mean, it's obviously him, but she gets two great performances out of him, probably his two best performances, maybe, or up there. Anyway,
right.
There's something to be said for that.
Yeah, it's, you know, he's one of those actors, not to get off track, but he's one of those actors you see in everything, you like in everything. But again, it wasn't until later when I was like an adult that I saw stuff like Chilly Scenes of Winter or Cutter's Way, and it was like, oh wait, this guy's capable of truly great, like transcendent work. And I've really only seen him play kind of these smaller character parts, and I'm always happy to see him pop up, but you don't realize what some of these actors can do when given the opportunity. And you know, she gave him the opportunity.
Yeah, no, I mean, for some reason the metaphor that popped into my head is like, you have a Formula One race driver and they're incredibly capable and skilled, but you give them like a trike,
right?
You know, and that's all that they can ride around the track, you know, and they're like pretty good, but you know, they can do so much better. And he's like, I don't know, some kind of hidden chameleon of an amazing actor that if you watch Chilly Scenes and Cutter's Way, it'll just blow your mind. Cause you'd be like, whoa, that's the dad from Home Alone. Yeah, and he was right. Really fine in that, but wow. You know,
that's so, the guy from I Chud. That.
Exactly.
All right. My next pick is another HBO staple for me as a kid and sort of sounds like the kind of dopey romantic comedy that I was just criticizing. I made kind of a dig at There's Something About Mary. I really like There's Something About Mary. I didn't mean to use that as an example, but, it is a movie called Casual Sex, which looks, based on the marketing, and sounds like this idiotic sex comedy. And it sort of wants to be, but it can't, because it can't help but be a lot smarter and a lot better. It's directed by Genevieve Robert, and it's written by Wendy Goldman and Judy Toll, who I think started it as a stage play. And it stars Leah Thompson, previously mentioned, and Victoria Jackson as two best friends who go stay at sort of this week-long health spa in the hopes of, you know, hooking up with a guy, basically finding love. And they both meet people. Victoria Jackson kind of ends up hanging out a lot with Jerry Levine from Teen Wolf.
Yes.
And Leah Thompson ends up with, oh my gosh, I can't remember the actor's name. But he's great. He's like the guy from Give Me an F. Anyway, right? There's a reference. So it wants to be this dumb comedy about like sex and dating in the 80s, and it is partly, and it's kind of making fun of the health craze at that time, and they go on, you know, a series of bad dates, but as it progresses, it gets a lot smarter, a lot more insightful, a lot sweeter. And I don't want to spoil anything about the movie, but the thing that I always mention is that it's one of the few movies I've ever seen where I was actually surprised at where it ends up. Most romantic comedies, it gives you two actors and, okay, they're going to not be together for 90 minutes. And then in the last 5 minutes, they're going to get together. And that's what we paid to see. And this movie goes about it a very different way, and I give it a ton of credit for that.
That's cool. I haven't seen this one again forever.
Okay.
I remember liking it, but I don't remember the ending, so I don't remember the unconventionalness of it. And yeah. I I need to check it out. I saw it's coming to Blu-ray relatively soon, I think.
It is, sometime in July, but it's like weirdly expensive for a catalog title. It's like over $20 on Amazon right now. And I was like, eh, if you knock that thing down to $10, I'll order it.
Yeah, yeah, that's not a $20. I mean, I don't remember the ending. Maybe the ending is worth an extra $10, but at this time, it seems like a $10 movie to me.
Yeah, yeah. And hopefully, you know, eventually it's one of these Universal catalog titles. I think those drop pretty quickly because I definitely would order it, but yeah, not for $20. Stephen Shellen, by the way, is that actor's name? That's it.
Don't know.
You would know him as soon as you saw him. He's on a pretty famous episode of Tales from the Crypt, and he's just a guy who acted a lot in the 80s and 90s.
But most known for Gimme an F.
Well, of course. Have you seen Gimme an F?
I have seen Gimme an F.
I mean, it has that memorable, like, barn dance sequence. So that's him. He's the barn dancer.
Stephen All right. Shellen. Very cool. Very nice. No, that's cool. I think Leah Thompson I've had a crush on since I first saw her, like, ever. And Victoria Jackson is oddly charming to me, too, for some reason. I don't know. There's something about her that I just find amusing, you know?
Well, and this is a movie that kind of knew what to do with her unconventional approach to acting or her kind of weird line delivery, you know?
Yes.
Sometimes I think directors didn't really know what kind of a part to give her. And I think this gives her a really good part.
Yeah, no, I think I do remember her personality or her character working really well with the material. And yeah, the only other time I think I thought she was decently cast, although it was a pretty conventional role, is UHF, except it's more like that. The whole movie is just kind of off. So, her quirkiness just fits in, but she's really just a thankless, you know, annoyed girlfriend character, unfortunately,
in that movie. For sure.
All right. So next on my list is Tapeheads, directed by Bill Fishman. This one, it feels like it's one of those quasi underrated movies because when I bring it up, some people are just like, oh yeah, of course, Tapeheads, yeah. And I'm like, well, yeah, no, I agree, of course. But I think sometimes for me, one of the sort of telltale signs is, does it have a special edition Blu-ray right now? And that's not to say that anything that doesn't is necessarily underrated, but I feel like a cult movie of this stature with, you know, John Cusack and Tim Robbins and others should have some kind of a special edition Blu-ray right now if it was rated properly.
Right.
But that's just one man's opinion. But this is a, you know, it's a cult film about two losers who sort of accidentally break into the music video industry. And it's just amusing because it's definitely of its time in terms of, you know, the kind of videos that they're making. And it's got a really interesting John Cusack in that he's not necessarily very likable.
Right.
and he didn't play a ton of unlikable characters. And I kind of like him unlikable, if that makes sense. I don't know if it really worked. Anyway, I think just the way that he plays it, he's just kind of a dick and kind of always using somebody or another, including Tim Robbins, but is genuinely friends with him and has ambitions about Tim Robbins' talent as a potential music video director. So it's kind of a conflicting thing. But anyway, they have a favorite band called the Swanky Modes, and they try to get them a new audience by hijacking a Menudo concert. And anyway, I won't go too far into it, but they do a great commercial for Roscoe's Chicken and Waffles, which is an actual restaurant chain in Los Angeles, in which, by the way, if you ever are in Los Angeles, I highly recommend going and getting chicken and waffles from, because it's ridiculously good. But the first time I ever heard of that chain was through the commercial that these guys make in this movie. But yeah, it's just an oddball film with, like, you know, a lot of satirical strangeness, and it's produced by the Monkees, Michael Nesmith, I think that partially accounts for that. I mean, if you watch something like Head, which obviously he's not totally creatively involved in, but it's, you know, there's definitely a sense of making fun of the industry that I would imagine at least is fueled in part by Nesmith. He can't have not contributed anything, I wouldn't think, having been in the industry himself for all that time. So it's just got a really unique perspective, and I think Robbins and Cusack are fantastic together, and they have one of the best like secret handshake things I've ever seen, and I really would love to think that they actually do it when they see each other.
I totally came to this movie by way of Mike Nesmith because I grew up like a huge obsessive Monkees fan.
Nice.
When I was like 5 years old, I had this hat with the little pompon on it, and I called it my Mike hat, and I wore it everywhere, like in my house.
Oh, that's awesome.
Right? And I was, I love the movie Head, and I was so delighted to hear it come up on a recent episode of Pure Cinema. I recorded it once.
So good. So
yeah,
good.
Yeah. So for years, it was like not available at all. And I,
yep.
TNT showed it at like 3 a.m. once, and I recorded it, and like it was my most prized possession because you couldn't get the movie anywhere. And then probably 2 or 3 years after that, you know, I think Rhino put out the VHS and then the DVD, and then there's a Criterion. Like, this is the world we live in now. There's a Criterion Blu-ray of the Monkey's Head. God, it makes me happy. Anyway.
Me too.
So that's how I came to this movie. And it's the kind of movie that I feel like even in 1988, you could tell was a cult movie. Like, it was like,
yeah,
as they were making it, it was already a cult movie just because it has such a weird energy. It has such an offbeat sense of humor. The cast is made up of just like the craziest assortment of people. I mean, recognizable people, musicians, character actors, celebrities, just crazy, crazy stuff. The music is by Fishbone. I mean, there's like, this is a wild movie, and I totally get what you're saying about Cusack, you know, with his kind of like John Waters pencil mustache. And it's interesting because even at the time, you know, he was kind of he had done a bunch of teen movies, and he was kind of this young romantic leading man. And you can tell already at this point in his career, he's kind of pushing against that and wanting to do more outrageous stuff, you know, which is really cool. Yeah. Yeah. This, I really like this movie a lot. I am fortunate that, you know, I bought the DVD way back when it was out because it's been out of print for a long time, I think.
Yeah. It's one of the holdouts from the Anchor Bay stuff that still needs some love. And, I got it too. And it's got a commentary. It's really a nice DVD, but yeah, I guess I just was like, I'm going to keep, you know, waving the flag for this one until it gets a Blu-ray from somebody. It's a perfect Shout Factory title.
Totally.
It should be a Shout Select.
Yeah,
you know,
totally.
It's 100% in their wheelhouse. But, you know, it's not as easy as just like, we should do that movie. Obviously, there's studio deals and all kinds of different things that, you know, I'm sure it's on their list. But boy, would I love to see Tapeheads get a nice Shout Select Blu-ray. That would be amazing.
And it is, like you said, very much of its time. So I get that there may be a generation of people who would watch it and just not even understand what it's satirizing, because MTV doesn't exist anymore, right? And it's like, what is this making fun of? But I think for people, you know, who are our age, I think it completely holds up.
Yeah, I think it could work somewhat for younger people because there are obviously still music videos. But yeah, they're just doing a lot of different things stylistically than they were in the 80s. So that may take people out. But I think if you like John Cusack and Tim Robbins, that could carry you through this. Their enthusiasm is pretty catching.
And I also infectious. You know, that Cusack shows up in Tim Robbins' other movies, right? His directorial movies. He shows up in Bob Roberts. He shows up in Cradle Will Rock. And so I love that, like, this is where that friendship started and that it continued through all these other movies. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, I agree. That's really cool. Are they both, like, Cusack's from Chicago, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is Robbins from Chicago? I don't know.
I don't think so.
Okay, so they must have encountered themselves, like you say, on this movie or in some other context. But yeah, that is cool. I love it when actors sort of follow each other and, you know, become part of the stock company of somebody if they become a director. Right. I just think that's great.
Yeah.
So,
speaking of Shout Select, my next pick is a movie that recently, maybe within the last year, got a Shout Select Blu-ray. And that is the Peter Weller, Sam Elliott buddy movie Shakedown.
Nice.
Written and directed by James Glickenhaus, who, you know, was known for kind of making exploitation trash. He had done The Soldier with Ken Wahl, and most famously he had done The Exterminator with Robert Ginty, which is, you know, what happens when your dad becomes a vigilante. And so it was nice to see, it was cool to see him kind of get a shot at the big leagues, and here's a studio budget. And, it's just a really, really cool kind of cop movie. Sam Elliott is a cop, who's part of a corrupt force, and Peter Weller is a lawyer who's sort of trying to bring down some of that corruption. And they partner up. There's just some, you know, there's a cool sequence on a roller coaster. There's a really cool sequence on an airplane at the end of the movie. It's just, you know, Glickenhaus is one of these guys who just knows how to make movies. He knows how to put a movie together. And there's an unappreciated, I think, art to some of these filmmakers. And I've tried to champion them before. I mean, Dwight Little is one of them. You know, Jack Shoulder is another one. Just people who, it's this kind of no-nonsense, like, this is how it goes. And they know exactly how to pace a scene, how to structure a scene, how to edit. And he just gets how movies work. And Shakedown, I think, plays really, really well. And actually, I don't want to spoil one of your picks, but I happen to know what one of them coming up is. I think this would make an awesome double feature with one of the picks that you have coming up.
Oh, interesting.
In terms
yeah,
of...
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah,
I could see that.
Right. They're these, again, they're kind of action movies for adults. They're not gratuitous shoot-em-ups. They're not sort of about these cartoonish Supermen kind of in the Schwarzenegger vein. It's a very different kind of action movie. And again, one that I think went out of fashion by the 1990s, by about the mid-90s, when action movies kind of pivoted away to something else. Movies like Shakedown went out of style, and it's a shame. And so the Shout Factory Blu-ray, I feel like, has actually done a lot to put this movie back on people's radar, because it was a movie that I just did not hear talked about for years and years and years. And
absolutely not.
Yeah. And now it seems like people are either rediscovering it or discovering it for the first time, which is really cool. I mean, any movie where, you know, you get Peter Weller and Sam Elliott, like, as your two leads is going to be worth watching. And especially when it's as cool as this one is.
Yeah, no, I was going to say Peter Weller and Sam Elliott just make everything better. Yeah. Really. Anything that they touch is better. And yeah, they're both, I just watched this for the second time in a long time when that Blu-ray came out, and I forgot, you know, how much I enjoyed it and how crazy the ending gets. I'm not going to spoil the ending, but it gets kind of nuts and it goes in a place where I didn't expect it to go. But I just think the two of them are just, I mean, Weller might be one of my favorite actors of all time. I just recorded a Just the Discs on of Unknown Origin with John Cribbs, and as we were talking about that movie, I was just thinking about him as an actor, and I was like, God, he is really somebody that I will watch in anything, and has almost never disappointed me, at least surrounding what he's doing. But he almost always makes interesting choices for movies too. So I don't know, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a fun one, and I was just revisiting RoboCop last week, and I was going through a lot of the special features, and just giving me entirely new appreciation for what he does in that movie. Because again, I've, you know, watched that movie my entire life, and it's just like, yeah, he's the guy that plays RoboCop, he's the guy in the suit, but you don't quite realize until you start thinking about it just how difficult a physical performance it is, how much he has to do with just his voice. And just even what an impression he makes as Murphy before he becomes RoboCop. So I totally get it. Like, he's a guy who, if you find out he's in a movie, you know, you're at least in good hands, you know, because he does have a pretty good crap detector, I guess, and doesn't make a ton of garbage. So, yeah, if I see Peter Weller's in a movie, I will definitely check it out.
Yeah, very sharp guy too. If you ever hear him interviewed, he'll kind of blow your mind.
Yeah, for sure.
Because he's so intelligent. I don't know what kind of degrees he has, but I feel like the guy's got like a couple doctorates or some shit. He's just really, really, really smart guy. All right. My next one is Shoot to Kill.
There it is.
That's the one. Yeah, this is weird. This is one of the movies. My family had an odd tradition of latching onto odd R-rated movies as our family movies. I mean, we also love like On Golden Pond and stuff like that. But I'm trying to think, like, Summer School's not R-rated, I don't think. But there's some other R-rated comedy that I can't think of it. But Shoot to Kill was like a family favorite for a while. Because my dad was really into the Night, and even so he liked the movies and the TV show, and so he liked Sidney Poitier, and I think that was the pull into this one. Mm-hmm. But it is like you say, it's a really great adult drama action movie. You know, not like too many films you see now. I guess maybe something like Wind River or something slightly compares to it, but ultimately, it's the story of a FBI agent played by Sidney Poitier who is tracking this kidnapper, extortionist, killer who has escaped him and escapes into the mountains of Washington, I think, near Canada, where the killer, joins a fishing expedition led by Kirstie Alley, who's a very 90s actress that I like, but she's not in movies anymore. So he joins this fishing expedition, and then Sidney Poitier gets Tom Berenger, who is like the best tracker survivalist in the area, that also is, I think, dating the Kirstie Alley character, to help him track them and find the fishing party, which has gone up in the mountains. The fun part of the movie that I'd forgotten about is that there are like five guys in the fishing party, and we don't know which one is the killer. Mm-hmm. And so you have kind of a John Carpenter's The Thing like scenario, and it's increased by the fact that Richard Mazur is in the movie. And I don't want to give anything away, but I feel like there's a healthy nod to The Thing in this whole thing. But then, so you've got, Clancy Brown is another one of the guys in the group. And then you've got Andy Robinson, who plays the killer in Dirty Harry, you know? So you've got a couple, you know, suspects where you're like, ooh, that guy could really be the one. Oh, wait, that guy, you know? So anyway, it's kind of fun to see, although it doesn't take that long to play out. And I kind of wish they'd drug it out a little longer. It's kind of fun to see like the different characters doing things that look suspicious, and you're like, oh, I don't know. And then when the reveal finally happens, it's pretty good. And then it just turns into like a more straight ahead thriller action kind of thing where they're chasing them through the woods and whatnot. But yeah, I don't know. There's something about, the idea of, the sort of remote location of the movie. I feel like they don't do those. I guess now I'm thinking of The Mountain Between Us and some other movies that have just recently come out. There's always an example of something, but for the most part, I feel like there's something about that remote location that I really like. And then again, I guess I've got a thing about fish out of water business. Although that's my least favorite part of this movie is, you know, Sidney Poitier is the city cop, and oh geez, he can't ride a horse. Isn't that funny? It doesn't, that stuff is really clunky, and I almost wish they wouldn't do it, but it is what it is. It's fine. I think at one point Tom Berenger says it's 3 days to the nearest telephone, which is like, wow, just the day and age we live in now, it's just hard to imagine, being out of reach so far, you know, the way, and it's kind of sad that that's the case, that we can't, you know, we can go off the grid, but anyway. There's something about Tom Berenger and Kirstie Alley and some of these actors that I associate with the late 80s and the early 90s when I was watching a lot of movies with my family and when I was starting to work at the video store in the, I think, early 90s. So I just would see these people all the time. They were like, don't want to say they were like friends. That makes me sound really sad. But they were they were like people that I saw at work a lot. So we were like coworkers. How about that? No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, they were just familiar people. They were my Hollywood. They were the big stars to me. They were, you know, what Burt Reynolds was to people in the 70s and 80s. You know, I mean, Burt Reynolds is a big deal to me too. But so yeah, Kirstie Alley and Tom Berenger were like the top of the line talent as far as I was concerned at the time. And it's just interesting how the actors cycle through Hollywood and then kind of disappear and occasionally come back, but mostly get sort of pushed aside, which is, you know, kind of a sad phenomenon. It's just one of those things. So anyway, good thriller though.
It's a terrific thriller and a really, really good pick. It's so funny that you said this was like one of your family movies, because it absolutely was for me and my siblings. And I don't know why we were allowed to watch it. Like, again, we were all kids. It was rated R. I don't know what our interest even would have been, because there's nothing there really for kids. And yet we were all very drawn to it. And watched it a lot. And it's funny because I was pretty young, I guess, when I saw it. And at that point, you know, didn't have like autonomous access to a video store. As much as I obsessed over movies, my family didn't. We maybe went to see one a year. Like, I would ask every week and we would maybe go once a year. So I was limited in terms of my knowledge. I would like study the back of the TV guide, and that was about as much as that was my education. So my entry into this movie was Kirstie Alley. She was the one that I recognized because of like Star Trek II, and I think at this point she had been on Cheers. So she was really the only person that I knew. I didn't really have much familiarity with Tom Berenger, and it's hilarious growing up and finding out just how important and what a towering figure Sidney Poitier is in Hollywood history, because for the longest time, to me, he was just the Shoot to Kill guy. Like, oh, the guy from Shoot to Kill. My sister like was, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8, and developed this massive crush on Tom Berenger, which I just thought was so weird. Like, for a kid, that was her big Hollywood crush, was Tom Berenger, just based on this movie. But yeah, I totally remember like the reveal, that scene you're talking about with the bridge. I mean, it blew my mind as a kid. I was like in such suspense. I was like, what a twist. Oh my gosh. I remember that scene so well. I haven't seen this movie in a long time, but I was a big fan of it.
Yeah. The twist is great, especially if you're old now and you can't remember who the killer is.
Exactly. Right.
I was just like, oh, I'm all in, man. I do not remember who it was. It could easily. Nope. It's definitely, and another movie, again, I'm rating it based on the fact that it doesn't currently have a Blu-ray release, but I think there's hope, because Kino Lorber Studio Classics has been cranking on Touchstone and Hollywood Pictures releases, and they've done Tom Berenger movies, and they've done, I think, Sidney Poitier movies. So come on, it just seems like it's gotta be coming. It's gotta be in the works. And I hope they get some kind of a commentary or something, because I'd love to hear a little bit more about it after all these years of seeing the movie, you know?
Yeah, I would buy this in a heartbeat if they put it out. So get on it, Kino.
Here's hoping.
My fourth pick is, I guess, my worst pick. Like, maybe this is like the plain clothes spot, I guess. I have no defense.
It'd be an interesting double with plain clothes.
I have no defense for this, but
I love how high it is on your list.
Well, I didn't necessarily put them in order.
Okay, I'm gonna pretend that you put them in order.
Oh, for sure.
This is your number two.
The second most underrated movie of 1988. So I honestly, if I was doing this show with anyone else, I don't even know that I would put this on here. But I'm like, if anyone can appreciate this, it's Brian Sauer. So anyway, and that is Satisfaction, starring Justine Bateman. This was the big push to make her a movie star after her success on Family Ties. And it was basically the only opportunity she had to be a movie star. And of course, the movie was sort of a legendary bomb and critically reviled. But she plays the lead singer of a band called Mystery, that is also made up of Trini Alvarado and Scott Coffey on keyboards. And
quick Scott Coffey used to be a regular customer at my video store here in LA circa 2000. He would come in once a month or so, and I didn't talk to him a ton about, you know, shag or satisfaction,
yeah,
but I always wanted to. and I always recognized him. I'm like, oh, that guy, you know, he just immediately, anyway, it's funny that he's part of the band.
He is. He sure is. Trini Alvarado on drums, Scott Coffey on keyboards, Britta Phillips, who was, I think, the only actual musician in the band, because she was in the band Luna, and I believe was the voice of Jem on Jem and the Holograms.
Whoa.
Yeah. And on bass, a little unknown actress by the name of Julia Roberts. So it's hilarious to watch this movie now and see that many members of the band kind of became more famous and successful than Justine Bateman. They decide to go out west for the summer and they become the house band at this club, and hijinks ensue. Justine Bateman begins a relationship with a kind of burned-out music executive played by Liam Neeson, whose name is Martin Falcon. And she serenades him at his home. It is just... listen, this is not a good movie, but it is a movie I could watch anytime. Like... I could tell you that I don't have the soundtrack to this in my car, but I would be lying because I 100% do. They do covers.
Oh, that's right.
They do Mystery Dance. They do, of course, Satisfaction over the end credits. You don't hear the song until the very end credits. They do Ico Ico. They do Knock on Wood. And Justine Bateman, bless her.
I know where this is going.
The decision was made at some point by someone to let Justine Bateman perform her own vocals. And I'm of two minds about this, because on the one hand, I don't like when there are like bands or singers in movies and they're clearly lip syncing. I really like when the actor is actually singing, you know.
One of my only problems with Back to the Future, is like that just does not look like Michael J. Especially because you can go and watch him now in the light of day, and he's actually singing. I think
he is. Yeah, he is,
and he's pretty good.
Yeah.
In that.
Yeah, yeah. Where's the Blu-ray for that? Where's the DVD for that? For crying out loud!
Oh, don't get me started. Yeah, that's one of the Paul Schrader movies that I really hope. I'm sure there's, you know, musical song hang up stuff, but man, it needs a disc.
Yeah.
I would say that I would also be lying if I said that I didn't have this movie on vinyl on my shelf right about 5 feet away from me right now.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
So I should have it in my car, but I don't. But yeah, So you're the mindset that you don't like to see people dubbed, but you don't also like to hear
she's not great.
Yes. I kind of like it when a movie kind of commits to that, though, and they're like, yeah, we know, but we're just going to go with it, okay? Just pretend she's better than she is. And they don't make a point of it being like a joke that she can't sing. You're supposed to believe the band is good and she's good. And then you just let it go, you know? But I'm with you. I'd almost rather have a less than great actor singing their own vocals than a really obviously dubbed actor, because that pulls me out of the movie every single time.
Yeah. Yeah, that was one of the things that I liked. The Woody Allen movie, Everyone Says I Love You. There's a bunch of people in that movie that are not great singers, but like that was part of its charm, that these were really actor, with the exception of Drew Barrymore, like these actors were really singing and kind of putting themselves out there. And I really liked that. So, you know, Justine Bateman putting herself out there. I'm glad that she's singing live. It just is maybe not great, but I have just a weird relationship to this movie. I've always been such a fan of it. I remember when NBC aired it in the late 80s and tried to change the name, because it was produced by NBC. There was like a short-lived NBC Films, and Aaron Spelling was a producer on this. And it didn't do well, and I think NBC Films was pretty short-lived. But so they put it on TV and tried to trick people who, you know, had avoided a movie called Satisfaction, and they called it Girls of Summer. And I remember seeing the commercial and being like, you're not fooling me. You're Satisfaction.
So, I'm going to watch you right now.
Yes. But it is directed by Joan Freeman, who plays like she was an actress. She's in Panic in Year Zero. I think she's probably most famous for playing Mrs. Jarvis, Corey Feldman's mom, in Friday the 13th, The Final Chapter.
Oh, wow.
She is the director of Satisfaction. So wow. Now when you watch Friday the 13th, you'll know what's in her future. It was like, this was a movie that was not available widely for a long time. And I remember like writing joke letters on the internet and publishing them to 20th Century Fox, asking them to put this out on DVD. And eventually they did, and it was a proud day. I take no responsibility for it, but I was still very excited. It is not yet available on Blu-ray, but there is a DVD if you want to check out Satisfaction.
I think you need to get your kids on the letter writing campaign for the Blu-ray of Satisfaction.
Perhaps. I think maybe we just need to get every one of our listeners to start bombarding 20th Century Fox. Asking with like a mystery reunion commentary, probably minus Julia Roberts because she might be busy.
Probably not going to hang out for this one now. But there's something about it. It was, I don't know, like there's this movie and Little Darlings, which I think is a better movie than Satisfaction. But like I have certain movies that I will watch at the drop of a hat and that my wife fucking hates. And I've just burned her out on Little Darlings. Like, I think the first time we watched it, she was like, oh, that was cute. And then the next couple times, I'm just a fucking creep because I'm watching this movie about, you know, girls at summer camp. But it's a really adorable movie. And Tatum O'Neill and Christy, never mind, I'm getting way off on a tangent here. My point is, I put on Satisfaction for my wife, I want to say middle of last year at some point. And we made it about 15 minutes and she just turned to me. She's like, this is terrible. And my wife doesn't do that. My wife doesn't stop movies much. She'll either fall asleep or, you know, just ride it out. But for whatever reason, she was just like, this is not good. I'm not going to watch this. I was like, damn it. I was really getting into it. Once you're 15 minutes in, you're like, all right. We're going to hear some covers soon. No, don't cut me off.
I mean, maybe it was just because she hadn't heard their best material yet. Like,
I think so.
Because they don't write an original until about 2/3 of the way when Justine Bateman performs Talk to Me to Liam Neeson. Like over breakfast after they sleep together. I am a fan of just like the not the movie One Crazy. I mean, I love the movie One Crazy Summer, but like I'm a fan of the One Crazy Summer movie, you know, Where the Boys Are, 84, just Shag being another one. I mean, Shag is a way better movie than anything we're talking about.
Yeah, Shag's good.
But this is, you know, that kind of a movie where it's just like, hey, we're friends and we're going to go goof around at the beach for a summer and play some songs and have a good time. And so I'm a fan of this subgenre. And while this isn't a particularly good example of that subgenre, I am inexplicably drawn to it.
Yeah, I think I have a thing for girl band movies, too. Like, I just like girls in bands.
Yeah.
I got to be honest.
Fabulous, so like, Fabulous Stains. What else are we talking about?
Fabulous Stains.
Josie and the Pussycats.
Josie and the Pussycats, definitely. Times Square.
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to think. Oh, man, there's one that's on the tip of my tongue. It'll come to me as soon as we start talking about another movie.
I sincerely hope it's Vicious Lips.
I have not yet seen Vicious Lips, although I am 100% sold on it after hearing you guys talk about it on the show.
Yeah.
I have the Blu-ray. I just haven't watched it yet.
That's another one. I remember the fact that there's a Blu-ray of Vicious Lips. We are clearly in the best possible timeline.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing what the stuff we can watch on Blu-ray now. Yeah. But yeah, I just, the girl band movies, I think, have always been a thing for me. I think I must have seen a girl bass player at a very formative age. And now when I see girl bass players in movies and in real life, I melt into a little puddle.
Sure.
And just roll down the drain. Yeah. It's really, there's something about it. Something really sexy about ladies like that play guitar and sing and rock the drums. I just think it's really cool.
The girl bass player for Mystery would go on to win an Oscar. So there's that. All right. So this is your fifth pick, right?
This would be my number one if we were doing it. It is, for all intents and purposes, kind of my number one, because it's my favorite movie.
I think mine might be too, but
okay,
the other four are not in order because Satisfaction is not my number two.
I do like that we talked about Satisfaction for a little while, though, and that's that's pretty great. Okay, so my number one, he comes up a lot on Pure Cinema, and that's Sidney Lumet. This is Running on Empty. It is, man, something else. One of those movies that I have certainly come to, my estimation and affection has grown greatly since I became a parent. And I remember one of my coworkers at the video store in college, we worked at a Blockbuster video. He had, I remember, it's weird, I remember a lot of my coworkers' employee picks for some reason. Because, like, especially certain movies where it wasn't something that everybody picked, you sort of forever branded that person with that movie. Right. At least I did. And so he had picked Running on Empty, and I had watched it. And I had been like, yeah, I like it, but I like other River Phoenix movies better. And I've watched it two or three times since I've had kids. And I watched it again last night. And holy shit, does this movie fuck me up. I mean, it is just an emotional, in the best possible way, an emotional nuclear explosion for me. It's just so, I mean, basically the story is of two parents that are on the run from the FBI after the 1971 bombing of a napalm lab. They work for some kind of like liberation army, or they were part of some group in the late 60s and early 70s. And so they ended up blinding this janitor that's in the building that wasn't supposed to be there. And so the bombing itself, and I guess the harm that they did to this guy, has made them one of the FBI's most wanted couples. And they have two children that they've been running with since they were born. River Phoenix's character, I want to say, must be 17 or 18. At one point, he says that he's been running since he was 2, and he's got a younger brother who's 10, who's basically been running his whole life. So they just, you know, go from town to town, and, you know, they'll pick up odd jobs, secretarial work, cooking. The two parents are played by Judd Hirsch and Christine Lottie, and they are fantastic. But it's just it's a really, you know, it's probably one of my favorite movies about family that I can think of. Because a lot of movies like sort of purport to be about it and end up being about it in a like kind of generic way. And that's fine. I get emotional about those too, cause I'm a sap, but this one, it's just, there's something about the family unit that they have and how they have to keep changing their names. And basically River Phoenix goes to a new school and encounters a teacher who gives a shit and realizes that he's like a prodigy on the piano and starts pushing him to like apply to Juilliard. And so the kid starts taking his own interests and needs above the family's for once. And the family is very resistant to letting him go because they know that once they let him go, they won't be able to see him because they're going to have to continue to be on the run. And so it's this real struggle for the parents in the movie to try and decide what to do about this thing, you know, on top of which River Phoenix has a great sort of romantic relationship with Martha Plimpton, who I just love. I love her in general, but yeah. I just love that she was in, you know, Goonies and like Mosquito Coast, also with River Phoenix, I think, actually. Right. Am I making a mistake?
No. Yeah. He's in that, right?
I think she's in that too. She's great. And I was telling my wife, I noticed a scene last night that I had missed somehow before, or just a little touch. At one point he goes over to her house and crawls in the window, which I always think is both uber creepy and uber romantic at the same time. And would definitely get you arrested more times than you would successfully woo the girl. But it happens a lot in movies, and I've always found that amusing. So he invites her to come downstairs and go outside and talk to him. She gets to the front door. She says, I don't have shoes. I have bare feet. He immediately takes off his shoes and gives her his shoes and walks barefoot himself off into the woods with her. And I just thought that's just the sweetest thing in the world. And I will remember that at some point and give my wife my shoes because that will surely win me some points. But
especially after it's make her watch Satisfaction.
Yeah, no, that's I may not recover from that. But so it's just a really remarkably acted movie, which is obviously something Sidney Lumet does incredibly well. He's just amazing with actors, and I think he gets some of the best performances from the actors he uses that I've ever seen from those actors. And there is a couple scenes in particular in this movie. There's one where, and I don't want to spoil too much, but Christine Lottie's character sees her father for the first time in 14 years. Mm-hmm. And I won't give away what's going on in that scene, but oh my God, did it just destroy me. And I was just weeping. More than I've wept this entire year in a movie. And I have cried in the theater several times. But just sitting on my couch watching this movie I've seen, you know, three or four times, I was again moved by it. And I think that's incredibly telling when you've already seen a movie. I think the tendency, at least for me, is that the emotional impact is often lessened, especially if you come back to it relatively recently. And I'd seen this movie maybe less than 2 years ago. So there's something to that when a movie can still move you and you've seen it three, four, or five times. I don't know. I don't know what it is. It's great performances. It's just mind-blowing stuff, and I love to be reduced to tears by a family story. So it's a bittersweet movie, but it's really well acted, and another one of those that makes you go, damn it, we lost River Phoenix too soon, and that's really a shame because I'd love to see what he'd be doing right now.
Yeah. This movie had always been on my radar because I remember Roger Ebert being a big champion of this movie. And I was sure that I had seen it, even when you said like that it was going to be part of your list. I thought, well, okay, I need to rewatch that one because I don't remember it too well. So I started watching it today and realized about 20 minutes in that I had never seen it.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. And everything you're saying was my exact experience. Like, this movie kind of devastated me.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. I mean, it's not even that it's purely sad, you know, because
no.
There is a lot of goodness and happiness and kind of hope in it, in particular with
yes.
River Phoenix and Martha Plimpton, and their relationship is just so great. But my good, I mean, I'm glad you brought up that scene with Christine Lottie and her dad, because the dad is the guy that played like the DA on Law and Order, right?
I think so. I recognized him, but I didn't know from what.
I think that's who he is.
Yeah, what's also great about the scene is it takes place in a restaurant.
Yeah.
And I kind of like when there's like social constrictions around a really emotional or volatile scene where they can't freak out and start throwing things at each other. Not that that would happen in this scene, but you could feel that they have to be a little quieter in the midst of this incredible emotional moment, you know, like one of the, you know, big life moments for both of them. They're just in a restaurant. People are, you know, eating spaghetti, you know. It's just one of those things where you feel that on top of everything else. But man, I really love it when you get to a scene like that and you're like, okay, you have that initial reaction, which is, oh, this is the one of the big emotional scenes of the movie. And so some movies will just kind of like play out that beat and they don't really develop or do anything other than be the emotional scene in the movie. And so my initial, you know, movie watching self is just like, oh, the emotional scene. All right, well, I'm probably going to get a little emotional here, but this will be over in a second. And suddenly I'm riveted, absolutely riveted by everything that they're saying. And I can't remember where the scene goes and I'm just weeping, you know, that crying where you're like not just tears running down, but like you're breathing in that way that you breathe when you're crying. I was doing that. So I'm like, that's another level of crying for me. But anyway, it's one of those movies you finish it. And if you have a family, you want to go and hug your children and but it's not sappy, you know? So there's, I don't know. Like I said, one of my favorite movies about family, I think I've ever seen.
For sure. It was really interesting to watch because, you know, I've always appreciated Sidney Lumet, and every time I watch one of his movies, it's like, hey, that's, you know, that's really good. Well, with the exception of, like, I recently saw, oh my gosh, Don Johnson and Rebecca De Mornay.
What, Hand That Rocks the...
Guilty as Sin. Guilty as Sin, which is Sidney Lumet. And you're like, how is this Sidney Lumet? Anyway, you know, he's not a director who's flashy, right? That certain filmmakers use certain tools in their toolbox, and Tarantino is going to use these tools, and Scorsese is going to use these tools. And Sidney Lumet's big tool is his actors. And so all of the focus in a lot of his best movies just goes towards getting the best performances and giving them a lot of room to create, you know, real characters. And I don't know that I've ever been more aware of that particular gift of his than in watching Running on Empty today, because again, you're talking about, you know, Judd Hirsch is always great, but he's not usually given a role like this. Christine Lottie, always great, not usually given a role like this. And so again, like we were saying with John Hurt, to be able to watch them do this incredible work, you know, because Sidney Lumet kind of allows them to do that and perhaps gets it out of them. I don't know. But, you know, to a person, everyone in this movie is amazing, including Law and Order guy, who only has the one scene. And it's like the most devastating scene in the entire movie. I mean, I was excited to see Kit Carson show up, and I don't know him as an actor. He's a screenwriter. But he gets a supporting role in this movie, and he's really memorable. And yeah, River Phoenix, man. It's a bummer. It's he's incredibly good at playing, you know, I mean, he's great at playing a lot of things, but he has a sensitivity that I don't know that anyone else in his generation had. I mean, you see it in Stand By Me, and I think you especially see it here, that his heart is really in the right place, but he's being kind of pulled in two different directions, and he wants to do the right thing, but he also knows that what's right for him. And it's just, I really was blown away by the movie.
I'm so glad that you watched it just on a whim to see if you had actually watched it.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Having a discovery. Yeah, it's really something. It's, I mean, yeah, one of my favorite River Phoenix performances, and he's given a lot of great performances.
Yeah.
I would put this up there with Dogfight, which is another one that I really, really like from him. And it's a somewhat similar character. Mm-hmm. There's a few more I'm blanking on at the moment. But, man, yeah, he really, like you said, there's something about that sensitivity. I think this role in particular is, I'd seen... like a Today Show interview with he and Martha Plimpton the last time I watched it. I think when this came out on Blu-ray initially last year, maybe. And the interviewer was asking about, you know, his home life and how, you know, he was raised as a hippie kid. And so I think there was a lot that he could really relate to in this particular character, not the FBI stuff, but the, you know, sort of hippie parent stuff. I think really helps him deliver an even more powerful performance. But yeah, he was something else, man. He was just one of those natural actors that could inhabit in a way that a few kids I've ever seen be able to do it. Yeah. You know, it's just, it feels so real. I don't know.
Everything in the movie. Yeah. Feels real. It's pretty incredible. My last pick is also a bit of a downer. This was, again, a movie that I came to fairly young because I had just discovered this new young actor by the name of Keanu Reeves, and I was immediately sort of drawn to him. I've always been a huge Keanu Reeves fan. And like River's Edge and Bill and Ted both came on my radar around the same time. And I was like, who is this guy? I really like watching him. He's really funny in this, and he's really good in this other thing. And, oh, what's this? He has this other movie that is also, you know, I remember it playing in theaters for about a week. And then when it finally showed up on HBO, that was when I made it a point to see it. And that is a drama called Permanent Record. And Keanu Reeves plays a high school student. He's kind of a fuck up. He wants to be a musician. And his best friend is played by Alan Boyce, and he's like kind of the star of the high school. I mean, he's like this gifted musician. He's helping tutor Keanu Reeves. He's like this brilliant student. He has this great future. He's got a great girlfriend. Everyone loves him. And so the first half hour of the movie is kind of just about their friendship and Alan Boyce's character, you know, feeling some pressure to always be the best at everything. And then they go to a party. It's just a typical high school party. Everyone's drinking, hanging out. Keanu goes out there on kind of a cliff, and this is a spoiler, but this is literally the premise of the movie, so I apologize. They're hanging out outside, and Keanu's kind of drunk, and he, you know, passes out for a second, and then he gets up, and all of a sudden his friend is gone, and he realizes that his best friend has jumped off a cliff and killed himself. And so the rest of the movie is about how everyone reacts to this suicide, and that's one of the things that... you know, it's a hard topic to address. I did not watch that 13 Reasons Why on Netflix. I know it was very controversial. Some people thought it was great. Some people thought it was exploitative. I didn't watch it. So I've seen some things that deal with suicide. I've never seen anything that deals with suicide as well as this, as honestly as this, and with as much, again, sensitivity as this, because it's talking about how his friends react, how the teachers in school, his father, who is played by the great Barry Corbin. There's even a scene where the principal of the high school kind of breaks down, and it's incredibly moving. And eventually, you know, there's a great cast of classmates, most notably Michelle Mayrink, who's always great to see show up and stuff, and Jennifer Rubin. And they decide to, well, I don't want to spoil anything, but the movie ends in kind of a musical number, because they're giving this performance of a Gilbert and Sullivan show. But it ends in this musical number that is among the most moving things I've ever seen in a movie, and it's impossible for me to watch without, as you said, completely breaking down. It's devastating, and Keanu Reeves is really, really good in it. You know, there was a time when directors really knew how to use him at this age as kind of a lost kid. He's playing a very similar role in River's Edge. There's much more of a sweetness to him in Permanent Record, but it's just a movie that is really under the radar and that I don't hear talked about very much, even in terms of Keanu Reeves movies. And when all that conversation was going on about 13 Reasons Why, I never heard anyone say, hey, check out Permanent Record. It does this way better. But it's just a really good teen drama, you know, that doesn't talk down to teenagers at all. And, you know, presents them as real people with real fears and feelings and concerns and sadness and hopes. It's a terrific movie.
Yeah, I agree. I like this one a lot. I've only watched it maybe twice in my life because it is a little bit of a tough sit.
Yeah.
But River's Edge is one of my favorite films of all time.
For sure.
So just being Keanu River's Edge adjacent means a lot and goes a long way for me. I appreciate that you made me think about this movie again, and I realized it was on Amazon, I think in HD, you could buy it for like less than $10. And I'm like, oh, hell yeah. You know, it still doesn't have, again, another non-Blu-ray, at least in the States, film, and one that is probably one of the Paramount titles that's out of print on DVD. So it may not be easy to see on disc, but I was like, well, I definitely need to own it because it's one of those sort of quintessential underseen 80s films. And you're right, it does handle the subject matter in like a really amazing way. Before I forget, there's a new-ish podcast as part of the Talk Film Society network called Keanu Believe It.
Yes.
And the guy's going chronologically through Keanu's filmography. I think he's got 4 or 5 episodes. He just recently did Permanent Record. If you want to listen to a conversation specifically about that film. But yeah, Keanu, another actor like River Phoenix that has his own kind of authenticity that is not like anybody else. You know, I can't quantify it. And those are the actors that I end up remembering. Like, they exist in their own universe, and what they're doing doesn't necessarily seem like acting. It's just this other thing. Yeah. And he's great in this. Yeah, it's a really, really good movie. I was really excited when you picked this one, cause I'd gone over a bunch of lists of 1988 movies and somehow I had passed right over it, cause it's definitely a candidate for something that I would have considered had I seen it and not missed, that it was even from 88. So yeah, this is a great choice and definitely one of the ones of all the films we've talked about that I would, I'd back you up on everything you picked, and I think everybody should see all the films we're talking about, but like, this is definitely one of the highest recommends I could give as far as the movies we've discussed.
Yeah. I mean, I think definitely this and Running on Empty, I think, are the two best movies that we've talked about, even though I like all the movies that we've talked about. Keanu had a big 1988, cause I realized as I was putting the list together for your site, I did include one other Keanu, but then I left off a third one. Because in addition to Permanent Record, he was also in The Prince of Pennsylvania, which our friend Stephanie, I believe, is either just recorded or is recording the episode of Keanu Believe It about Prince of Pennsylvania. So she'll be on that. So everybody listen
nice.
To that.
Nice. That's awesome.
And he was also in a movie called The Night Before, which like couldn't be more different than Permanent Record in terms of like it's just a completely goofy teen comedy. It's the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of what he's doing here. But he gives three very different performances in all of those movies. And I like all three of them in different ways. But yeah, Permanent Record is easily the best of the three. And as we were talking, I did look it up. You can still find it on disc, but it's on Amazon to own in HD for $5.
Yeah, so it was cheap.
Everyone should just go ahead and blind buy it and watch it and prepare to cry.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Yeah. Before we get off the topic, I'm a big fan of The Night Before.
Me too.
And you had brought that up. Yeah, that's a great like high school after hours.
Yeah.
You know, it's like for me, it goes like after hours into the night. And then a little ways down The Night Before, which is still a really fun movie. But, you know, I love Keanu Reeves and I love Lori Loughlin. Those two alone would be enough to carry a movie for me. But then it's, you know, one crazy night comedy. I mean, come on. That's that's right in my wheelhouse.
Well,
know?
And it's, so it's, anyway. It's Tom Eberhardt. And he can never make – he never approaches the genre he's working in straight on. He always comes at it from sort of this weird side angle, with the exception of maybe like Gross Anatomy. I feel like that's pretty straightforward. But whether it's
Night of the Comet.
Night of the Comet. What's the one that I can't think of that Elric's always talking about? I can't think of the name of it right
Soul
now.
Survivor.
Soul Survivor. Soul Survivor. Oh, my gosh. I was like, Final Destination. Yeah. No, that's the one he's always comparing it. Soul Survivor, Night of the Comet. Right. He's always kind of coming at it from this weird direction, and that's definitely what The Night Before is.
Yeah, Without a Clue does the same thing.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Without a Clue. Yeah.
A different angle. But, yeah, anyway, that's 88. It's Keanu. I just thought it was fun that he did – you're right, so much stuff in that year. But, yeah, Permanent Record – for sure, his best performance in and around that. I mean, that and River's Edge,
yeah.
I think, would be – I'm just looking at the rest of his stuff. Maybe my two favorites – I mean, I love – don't get me wrong. I love me some Point Break.
Yeah, he's given, like, good action performances. Like, I think he's in three of the best action movies ever made. Right. But in terms of his dramatic performances, it's definitely these two movies.
Yeah, these two, and I kind of like him in Feeling Minnesota, although I feel like time will not be as kind to that movie as I think it will be.
I want to love that movie so much more than I do. Like, it's unfortunately...
There's definitely one line... Yeah, there's definitely one line he has in there where he's like, something like, it'll turn to shit, I just know it, or something like that. It's really terrible, but there was a couple... But yeah, you're right. Maybe I'm... I think the thing that makes me want to like it is that there's... I think a kid watching the movie Critters I think Cameron Diaz is watching Critters in Feeling Minnesota. And because I think that's awesome, I want to like the movie more than I do.
I want to like it just because I love the opening credits and the Johnny Cash song. And I you know, the cast is great, but it's a little caught up in some of that like post Tarantino kind of nonsense.
definitely is. Anyway, sorry, I'm getting way off topic, but Keanu has that effect on me. I'm going to apologize.
This was super fun. Thank you so much for coming on to talk about this.
My absolute pleasure. I would love to do it again sometime. Like I said, I love your show. I love your writing, and I appreciate all the mentions that you've given me on the show. Incredibly kind, and I'm touched. So thank you very much for that, and for having me on.
It was a big honor to have you on, and it's always, you know, nice to be included in the stuff that you're doing, and you let me publish these lists on your site, and you're super nice. But yeah, everybody, make sure that you're checking out. Yeah, no, it's always super. I stress out about it, you know, because I'm like, I got to find something that nobody else is going to pick, you know, so that I can turn somebody on to, you know, some cool movie. But yeah, sometimes I just go snake eyes. But yeah, everyone check out Rupert Pupkin Speaks, you know, for the next probably few months, because these kind of trickle out over time, right?
Yeah, I'm going to probably do 2 a week. It'll be a slow trickle.
Yeah. So, and you'll get turned on to a bunch of cool movies after you finish these 10 that we've talked about. You know, definitely check out the site and find a bunch more titles. I love reading those lists. I get turned on to stuff all the time. And I've said this many times about Pure Cinema. I've said it to you off air. I've said it on air about your show. There's no other podcast that, like, as I'm listening to it, all I want to be doing is watching the whatever movie you guys are talking about, whether it's a movie I've never seen and I'm like, oh man, these guys make me want to watch it, or it's a movie I've seen 20 times. All of a sudden I'm like, fuck, I need to watch that movie right now. Like, it just has that effect on me. So thank you.
That is the highest possible praise you could give. And I'm truly honored. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. This was great fun. Happy 4th of July, everyone. And we will talk to you next week. Thank you, Brian.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.